This talk was given by Jody Hojin Kimmel Sensei at the Zen Center of New York City. Hojin Sensei is a resident teacher at the monastery and co-director of ZCNYC. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about the temple's retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org/ZCNYC. Thanks for listening.
The main case from the Hidden Lamp. Collection of stories of awakened women. One day, Master Zhao Zhao Kongshen was outside the monastery. He saw an old woman hoeing a field. He asked her, "What would you do if you suddenly met a fierce tiger?" She replied, "Nothing in this world frightens me," and turned back to her hoeing. Zhao Zhao roared like a tiger. She roared back at him, and Zhao Zhao said, "There's still this." Preface with a story of the Buddha from the Bhayabhairava Sutta, Fear and Dread. I dwelt in such awe-inspiring, horrifying abodes, orchard shrines, woodland and tree shrines. While I dwelt there, a wild animal would come up to me, or a peacock would snap a branch, or the wind would just rustle leaves, and I thought, "What now if this is the fear and dread coming?" And then I thought, "Why do I always dwell, always expecting fear and dread? What if I subdue that fear and dread while keeping the same posture that I'm in when it comes upon me?" While I walked, the fear and dread came upon me. I neither stood nor sat nor lay down till I subdued that fear and dread. While I stood on the corner, the fear and dread came upon me. I neither walked nor sat nor lay down till I subdued that fear and dread. While I sat, the fear and dread came upon me. I neither walked, nor stood, nor lay down till I subdued that fear and dread. While I lay down, the fear and dread came upon me. I neither walked, nor stood, nor sat down till I subdued that fear and dread. So I kind of linked these two together to inspire sort of an investigation of fear and dread. I've always loved this sutra. I just think it's just amazing that, you know, the Buddha, after having seen through all these hindrances and going to sit on his own, he still felt this very primal fear and dread, which I think happens to us. And I thought, since this is the season of giving, supposedly, it's marked, earmarked as that. I think that's every season, because that's one of our virtues, but okay, we do this in particular. And one of the major forms of giving is of giving someone protection from fear. And are we ready to do that for ourselves, for others? What do we say to our fear? So looking at Buddha's journey, being viewed as an investigation of suffering. You know, I said it many times, and many teachers do. The Buddha said, "I teach one thing, and that's how we suffer and how to put an end to suffering." And it began with his encounter of the four messengers. So he, you know, left his royal palace. It's nice to have the perspective of standing in that place in India and now imagining this. But he left his very protected life, and what did he see? Old age, sickness, death, and a mendicant, a wandering monastic. And all of these startled him and brought him into this deep questioning about me too. Me too? Am I subject to all of these things? And who's this wandering mendicant? Like, how are they? Why did that come in? So his realization of the Four Noble Truths, studying suffering, stress, some is listed as, to his awakening, realizing that nothing is bound. It all arose out of a direct encounter with fear. Buddha deliberately practiced fear, and this directly informed his opening. So, as I said, he eliminated most every other hindrance to his awakening, freed his mind from most ignorance, saw very directly what was real and true, but he still experienced fear. Sometimes we can call that Mara visiting, that aspect of us that suddenly throws doubt or just undoes what we know to be good and true in our path. That could be said as that Mara aspect of our mind that gets constricted and tight and narrow. And Buddha mind is much more womb-like, big, all-encompassing, flexible, malleable. So we kind of move our heart and mind as one character, like a valve. It opens, it closes, and it's like Buddha's just like opened, right? But still there was this little pulse of valve with this fear held by this grip of this very primitive response, we could call it animal-like response, I don't know. And then he realized that he does not need to fear his mind and thereby fear the world, thereby dread, not have to dread others. And a lot of this is, we're born into these kinds of situations, all of us. And then we're taught and it's reinforced and it starts this whole cycle of fearing one another. That's what the Buddha saw into his experience in meditation, in sitting down with himself, gave him the ability, the strength, strengthened his ability as it does ours to remain right here now. That's it. It's the coming to the present moment. The breath is only breathed now. You know, in our mind, we can go to the past and the future, but we're only living now. Now. It's like thus, you know, the Buddha's the Tathagata, the thus, the one that thus comes, the one that thus goes, moment to moment to moment. So he could practice in that ability to remain right here now to the experiences that were very unsettling to him. Just like this woman, in a way, nothing in this world frightens me. How could she say that? Right now. She's talking about right now. Because she knows she's human. You think she doesn't know what frightens her to some degree? And then she goes back to work. Just like we find meeting he did, meeting his thoughts, questioning their truth, allowed him to achieve the complete insight, calmness, and presence that had been evading him. So when we have a thought arise and we begin to practice it and see like, wait a minute, is what I'm believing true right now? Is it true? Then we get insight and it informs us in a very deep way. So one of the greatest gifts to give ourselves and others is no fear. He said, unflagging persistence was aroused in me and unmuddled mindfulness established. My body was calm and unaroused, my mind concentrated and single. Meeting and staying with the frightening aspects in his whole human situation. And in that, being able to use delusion, see how delusion is so perfectly made I mean, think about your delusions. Aren't they perfect, in a perfect accord with what we don't understand? They are so perfect. So we can get so much from them. And how do we know? Because we suffer. If there's a presence of a misunderstanding of ourself and it gets fixed and real and true, we will suffer from that. That's what we're seeing. That's a deluded and ignorant thought. It's not a curse. It's like, in my last talk, I said delusion's getting a bad rap. You know, we say, I'm so deluded. Well, who's saying that? Who could even say that? Who's seeing? We may notice that perfect craft of delusion and how it mainly concerns itself with protection. And when we look into the feeling of fear, we may say, see, we don't have to do this. Eventually, we begin to soften and say, when it comes, it's like, wait a minute, I don't have to do this. And it's hard because you have to have awareness and see it for what it is and then act upon that, make the shift, or keep believing and see where that goes, right? And we'll do that for a while. I've had many things which I see they're not true, but damn if I don't go right back to it. We don't have to smother reality with our impressions of it. I've always read James Baldwin, but because he talks a lot about the creative process and the artist as a shaman in the culture, that like, so he says, there are too many things we do not wish to know about ourselves. To accept or reclaim our past, our history, is not the same thing as drowning in it. An invented past can never be used. It cracks and crumbles under the pressures of life like clay in the season of drought. It's a great metaphor. And then, of course, that usually fills in with fear, those cracks. He says a lot, but to defend oneself against a fear is simply to ensure that one will one day be conquered by it. Fear must be faced. Love takes off masks that we fear. We cannot live without and know that we cannot live within. I use the word love here not merely in the personal sense, but as a state of being or a state of grace. Not in the infantile American sense of being made happy, but in the touch and universal sense of quest and daring and growth. Buddha sees day as day and night as night, no filtering of experience. Mara, that pull towards deadness, which comes from fear, is defeated. When we actually experience dukkha, so dukkha is the second noble truth. So first is life is stressful, suffers, and then the cause of that thirst to either, you know, move from where what's dissatisfying, to look for what's pleasurable, to get away with from what's not pleasurable, that we're stuck in sort of those two states. And then the third one is there's a way to put an end to that. And then he has those ways of understanding the Eightfold Path, right? We have to have right intention, right understanding, right mindfulness. So use all the distractions of the senses, all the self-building things we cook up for me-making, and maybe we seek to go into oblivion or self-destruction. When we meet intimately clinging and develop the capacity to connect our wisdom about it, we become alive to the world in a new way. And then that aspiration for bodhicitta, to raise our bodhi mind, that aspiration to help ourselves, to help others, deepens, rises. So this koan is a memorable encounter of an old woman. And you know who she's challenging? Zhao Zhao, Joshu. Joshu's Mu, some of you are working on that. This is him. That's who she's facing, right? So big authority figure here. Big guy in the Zen world. She's just an old woman swinging her hoe. And this is, you know, he's the master of the Tang Dynasty. And he is in this exchange. She says, nothing frightens me. So why is he's challenging, you know, this woman who's out there. Let me see. Just have to read it for a second. Yeah, so he's, I have to just read it for a second. So why is he bringing in this fearfulness, bringing in something to frighten her? Why is he doing this? So, you know, it's a little daunting to talk about fear because, you know, we're all pretty expert at it. You know a lot. I do too. So we have that with us. You know, it's not an enemy. A lot of us try and make it an enemy. We don't want it, a flaw. We think we're weak if we're afraid of something, something to conquer. And because we have so much aversion to the feeling of the discomfort of fear, we'll do almost anything to avoid it or, like, get out of here, get rid of it. And when I, and it's true that I find if I don't address it, that I will be trembling in some way. And I'll box myself into my fear, make it more solid. And what we're afraid of course, is a very long list. I'll name a few. You can add, it's kind of like endless, uncountable millions of things. Wow, it's like when you think about it, it's like every department you can name, somebody's going to be afraid of something somewhere. That we won't live forever, abuses of cruel people, or an indifferent, chaotic world, disease, pain, losing control, helpless, fear that we won't understand the Dharma, fear of the unknown, loss of loved ones, status, material security, being criticized, looking foolish, dying, afraid of dying process, afraid of being afraid, afraid of being the dark, the light, yellow, tight places, big spaces. It's not a joke. Intimacy, confrontation, sex, loneliness, responsibility, lots. Lots where we quiver. And Buddha, he just noticed and he went to the unlabeled, unadulterated trembling. We know when we feel it and it has a language of its own and sometimes it's wordless, especially in our body. So the first thing is to become aware, and this will be subtle and gradual, subtle and gradual, to feel the tremble and become aware that I'm afraid of something right now. And I remember early on in practice, I had a very strong expectation that I would be free, that this was the thing to do to free me from anxiety and fear. And I thought if I studied and sat and struggled to change my behaviors, behavior modification, I could replace the parts I didn't want with a new bionic improved version of me that was free of anxiety. And that gave me a lot of anxiety. I was like, oh my God, I'm so afraid of that. Oh boy. But I did become more aware to the extent of its presence. And then have you noticed too how it builds upon itself? So you let a little bit in and it just goes. So a little fear, and then it just attracts more of the same. If we don't kind of like get to it and hold it in a particular way, we'll see it everywhere. And it's like you're on an IV and it just keeps feeding it. So to break that cycle. And then sometimes that actually develops into terror, not just fear, but we're terrified. It's like a terror. And we often speak about terrorism, of course, in the world, but we don't necessarily acknowledge the terror that has invaded our inner world. Afraid of fear, afraid of admitting, even to ourselves, that we feel it. That's like, you know, it's like we have to live with ourselves. And it startles me in my own mind how I can't just be honest with myself how I feel or what I'm experiencing. That there's so much that I've been conditioned to or formed to that is telling me that should not be here. And it startles me every time. Like I can't even like, even if my, like if that my mind went there to allow that. And I remember, you know, one time where, you know, I told you about like just getting kind of really crushed and kind of leveled where I allowed all the imagination to come. The worst, the brutal, every parts that I could see, like just whatever wanted to, just let it, like I was watching a bad movie. Just watch it. That was really, what that did was very helpful in my whole, and the whole arrangement of my nervous system to just allow and see the many places we go. And sometimes we are so effective and super effective to the point of pushing back or holding the visceral body experience of fear that we may think we've actually eliminated it. You might find that too. So, Zhao Zhao notices this woman in the field. He may have heard her hoe tapping as she's digging, hitting rocks. But why does he need to confront her fearlessness with these fear-mongering words? And look how she wields her tools. Nothing in this world frightens me. It says, yet beware. An unclear gaze, and you may end up in the mouth of the tiger. She returns her attention to cultivating both field and mind, sowing seeds of virtue and compassion, the very foundation of the Buddhist teachings. So in that moment, what is she bringing in? What kind of field is wide open? Where is she living with the choice of memory, of knowing fear, and what's actually happening in that moment? And he tries, rah! And she goes, rah! To this great, great big hoo-ha, and then back to hoeing. So she was so living in her completeness, in a way, of who she was, and that was not there in that particular way in that moment. And she doesn't need to dredge it up. So where do we live? Where do we meet our fear? Fear is often hidden in mass, like the person who appears to be the center of a party, maybe the person who fears their own invisibility or rejection. This was fun to think about. Like perhaps the person who makes eloquent presentations at the workplace might be afraid of losing their job. Like my friend told me that, like she's so eloquent at making her presentation, but she's so afraid of losing her job. The person that takes up being an ally may be conquering some kind of fear within. Only we need to see the mask. If we don't, the more we experience terror, the more we experience we're divided, we're inauthentic perhaps, living the cycle all over, creating anxiety and despair. So terror can become, like externally, can become systemic, that we keep the whole system keeps reinforcing the way it's set up, terror. Then the strategies to eliminate the feeling, rearranging our external lives like furniture. So once I was going to do a podcast interview on the creative process, and I was like, this is my thing, you know? But I was like, this, you know, it's something I love, but, and I have sort of confidence in. But on my way to walking to the building where they were going to do the recording, I was like, fear was on my back, like this backpack that had like 100 pounds in it. Like that's how it was riding me. I was like, I am terrified. And my thoughts were moving really fast. And each one amounted to, I'm not going to know what to say. I'm not enough. I don't really know much about this. And so I started like freaking myself out with all this talking about it. And I'm going to go blank. I'm going to screw up. And mind you, this is just a recording, so it doesn't even need to be played live yet. So, but I couldn't, I had no intelligence in that moment. You know, we lose our intelligence when we're afraid. That's why safe places are so important, because, and why we have to create that, because we don't access our intelligence in some of these moments. So on the way over, I saw someone in the garden and they smiled and asked where I was heading. And I said, heading over. I told him where I was heading and that I was freaking out. And clearly he'd seen my lack of breath and how stiff my movements were. And my terror was quite visible. And I was embarrassed. And, you know, as I like rattled off, you know, sometimes we're in that mode. We can talk to anyone about our fear, like meet someone on the street or the subway, and you can just launch into like you're, what you're afraid of. It's just, it bypasses any sort of relational, you know, barriers. It's just like, I gotta tell you, I'm like, you know, and the people will listen because people are good, you know, most. And so, and I realized later in that moment or somewhere in there that for most of my life, I had made a lot of effort in looking calm when I was completely terrified. And in a way, if you can accept that you're terrified, you will actually be truly calm, in a true calm, because you're actually in accord with what's happening, not in the past, not in the future, but now. And so you can function. There's an intelligence that comes in when you acknowledge what's actually happening. But when we get in that split, that divide, we're disconnected, and then it just keeps going. And then he just assured me it would go well. So, you know, these little acts of kindness are this kind of giving that's so potent. You know, it's just, it's, and it's not from like who you might expect a lot of the time, but he just said, you're going to do fine. It's going to go really well. More confidence than I had. And, it turned out when the tape started rolling and the interview began, I did find myself speaking from my heart. I went right to it. Cause I'd practiced it a lot throughout my life, going to the place where I know I sit in through Zazen, that immovable seat that we touch that has this power and the strength in the hara to sit in our integrity when what's in front of us is like unbearable. And for some, it's always been that way. But then when it was over and the recorder was turned off, I had a whole other fear, which was, what did I say? What did I just say? And what had allowed me to release the terror, even for those few moments? I think it was that my mind refocused to my heart, to lower, and made the contact for what I live for most. So this is really important. Not just important, but, you know, in our work with our humanity, with one another, how we're going to love each other and see each other. It has to go way deep into finding our integrity instead of the fear smothering this with our past, with the impressions, not forgetting about it, not being informed by it, but not letting that rule what's right in front of us. How can we come to this moment as an unencumbered, non-suffering being, just like the old woman? She came to that moment as an unencumbered, non-suffering being. So in Zazen, we learn to cultivate and stretch those moments of being unencumbered, the state of non-suffering with each breath, moment by moment, breathing in and out. In Zazen, we can feel the fear without having to do anything about it in that moment. In the moment, we simply breathe. There's no past. There's no future. We're not harming, and we're not being harmed. The terror within is being attended to in a very gentle way. There may be tears or trembling, but we're alive. And when I first chanted the Heart Sutra, I was, and it still stuns me, that line, with no hindrance in the mind, no hindrance, therefore no fear. So to me, those words say that there was something in my mind that gave fear its power. With no hindrance in the mind, no hindrance, therefore no fear. So something in my mind that gave fear its power. Like the Buddha said, why do I dwell always expecting fear and dread? What if I subdue that fear and dread while keeping the same posture that I am in when it comes upon me? This word I spoke about before, hindrance, means in it's translated as asita, we may know from bodhicitta, asita, avarana, excuse me if I'm messing up the language, but is without. So to be with no, citta is mind, mental activity, and avarana is barrier or obstruction. So to be without a mind barrier. And Red Pine translated as without walls of the mind. Thus the bodhisattva lives prajna paramita, with no walls in the mind, no walls, therefore no fear. And Kant calls it thought coverings, that which covers or obscures our pure mental activities, that which obscures what would allow us to see clearly and directly, clothes that we put on thoughts to form them. I always thought of it as like when I grew up, my friend's living room had plastic on the furniture. It might be your house too, where you grew up. But I thought it was kind of like that's the coverings. Like I couldn't get to the material of the couch. It was always like through something. you know? And I was like, what, this is the living room. Like, what's the point, you know? I don't know. Anyway, these thought coverings, we call it ignorance, delusion. They're about stopping the flow of moment to moment, the free flow of life that's going on all the time. What gets it going again? So in the Faith Mind poem, it says, live neither in entanglements of outer things, nor in inner feelings of emptiness. Live neither in entanglements of outer things, nor in inner feelings of emptiness. So not pushing away this moment in order to create a different moment that we want to have, but actually meeting the truth of this moment with no hindrance, therefore no fear. It's not so easy, but that's the way the Buddhist teachings go. They sound, they're so simple, but then you like practice it and you're like, whoa, like breathing, whoa, being with the breath, woo, not so simple. And in those moments, not to go for a drink, a smoke, to the refrigerator, to the iPhone, in our trembling way, trembling away, but with no thought coverings, to stay, sit, and bring it down. This one has been not made to not tremble. I love that because it's active. You know, we think of fear as a thing that lives inside us, but trembling is a verb. Trembling is what we do in the moment we're afraid. We tremble. What is it like when you tremble? You know, maybe you're doing it now. Where do you feel it? Jaw, your stomach. You got a muscle that's going like diddy, diddy, like, you know. So to then place the eye of awareness on our trembling and become it, much like the pain that we feel, the physical pain, becoming what is happening right now. Be with this just as it is. We see how it changes. In this moment, it changes, always changing. It might feel worse, but we just tremble, tremble, tremble. But we're right, we're being it. We're just that. No thought coverings, just the experience. The Buddha spoke about, actually this is from the Abhidharma. It's a Buddhist scripture. The five great fears are listed. I think they're interesting to reflect on. The five great fears are, number one, fear of death. Number two, fear of the loss of livelihood. This is in the Abhidharma. Three, fear of unusual states of consciousness. Fear of loss of reputation. And fear of speaking before a public assembly. Yepper. And then there's also the common things that bodhisattvas fear. That's you. That's me. These are some common things bodhisattvas fear. The kinds of trembling, shall we say. The fear that we will not survive if we practice generosity. The fear that if we give it all away, we won't survive. It's when we don't realize, and this is from another teacher, so these aren't my original pieces, though I add to it. It's when we don't realize that in the giving, we have energized the relationship, that is the way it happens. We are creating generosity in the world, but we fear this. The second one is the fear of criticism. That if we try to help others, they'll criticize us. That's true. Well, they might. They do. We do. The third is the fear of death, that we won't be able to give ourselves fully to the world, that we'll be cut off. The fourth is fear of a bad existence, that our karma will be such that we can't serve. And the fifth is the fear of speaking before the assembly. It's the fear of embarrassment or of not being understood because you know it's impossible to say anything about so many things. We do our best and it's always misunderstood. Yet, we just keep doing it. If there's no mind to grasp and no permanent you or no permanent me to ridicule, then we don't have to tremble. There's just flow. There's just aliveness. We can be lighter about ourselves, through which the conditioning of fear can be experienced. With awareness, we can go into the solidity of fear and touch its porosity and what remains. So Zazen helps us to find a modicum of trust that it's very okay to be afraid, and then the healing begins. The wisdom in our bones comes alive. In the midst of fear and anxiety, the mind and body are begging to purge the terror within us. The waters of the mind can stop whirling and we can begin to see our reflection. We can see how we are fully equipped with all of our emotions to see what it means actually to be a human being, really. There is still this, Joshu says. Oops. There is still this. Though both the great Zen master and the old cultivator are poised and snarling, neither really pounces, and Zhao Zhao walks away with this. This what? This magnificent, joyous moment in life, or this fearful thing that is bringing grief. Don't smother reality or thisness with such impressions. What is the tiger in your life? What is the fearless old woman in you? What is the great timeless roar of no sound? The inexhaustible lion's roar. It points out to the deep stillness that's within us and spaciousness, and yet it does demand that we do act now. We have to cultivate this. And I'll end with a short poem by Octavia Butler. To shape God with wisdom and foresight, to benefit your world, your people, your life, consider consequences, minimize harm, ask questions, seek answers, learn, teach. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.